Welcome to the highlights of the Circular Republic Festival, Europe's leading event for advancing the circular economy, uniting corporates, startups, and innovators driving this transformation. We continue this series with a panel about re-commerce and textiles. The panelists are Christina Rosenberg, member of the supervisory board of Hugo Boss, Jens Ulrich, business development manager at Bergzeit, Matt Petersen, e-commerce product lead in the Fabrics Futures team at Gore, and Max Große-Luttermann, general manager Europe of Trof. This conversation is moderated by Karl Wagentin, founder of the circular textile platform at Circular Republic. But before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager of this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm.
Welcome to another textile deep dive session, and I couldn't be more happy about the topic that we're talking about today, which is re-commerce. And re-commerce is one of the hottest topics when it comes to circularity at the moment, and I'm super happy about it because when we talk about circularity, we a lot of times talk about recycling. And this is actually one of the, you know, really interesting business models, how we can actually show circularity in it, in terms of we make business, but we also do good for the planet. And we do that way before recycling becomes a topic. We at Circular Republic had a project going on now already for 1 year with almost all of our panelists today who were part of it. And we will talk, of course, also about the learnings from that, but also go a little bit beyond our e-commerce project and our learnings as well. So I'm very happy to be joined today by an amazing group of panelists who are Christina Rosenberg, who brings the brand perspective after many years with H&M and Hermes, and now serves as advisory board member for many companies, among others, Hugo Boss and Tretter, the shoe company here from Munich. We have Matt Petersen, who's from Gore. I think everybody knows the famous ingredient brand Gore-Tex, very well known for the high durability, but also one of the key drivers when it comes to regenerative business models and our re-commerce project at Circular Republic. Jens Ulrich from Bergzeit, a local store for outdoor materials, and one of the key drivers when it comes to re-commerce as a business model. And then, of course, Max Große-Luttermann, who is a true entrepreneur and founder in the space of the operations when it comes to re-commerce. And I wanted to introduce him as a CEO and founder today, but now actually that changed a little bit because he sold his company to Trof, which is a big American re-commerce company and manages now the European business for it. So please welcome our panelists to the stage. Christina.
Yes.
I would love to begin with you today. And you have a lot of diverse experience, right, across different brands and companies in the textiles industry. Can you please share, you know, your insights from innovating the retail business, especially considering sustainability?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me here. So I'm in my 30th year of working in textile business, and I always worked for strong brands such as H&M, Hermes, Hugo Boss, Villeroy & Boch, so always the brand was very strong with a lot of history and tradition. And I always used to work for family-owned business, which is very essential because I think if you talk about sustainability, it's part of their DNA, it's part of their mindset. And since I stepped out from operational business 7 years ago, so I just before turning 50, I said I want to do something with more sense, and I would like to use my experience in the operational business for more strategic issues to make the world a little bit better and also better for the next generations, One of my favorite words is Enkelfähigkeit. For those who understand the German word, for those who do not speak German, it's more that we take decisions today to make sure that also our grandchildren have a good planet, a good life, and we take really good decisions for the future. So what I learned, because I'm consulting also companies, the more you have listed companies and the more you have companies where you have, for example, private equity behind, the more you have to work with C-level first on their vision and mission to get a real view on sustainability. Because it doesn't make sense, even if you have legal constraints, that you do some projects. It's more or less then greenwashing if it's not in the mindset of the whole company. And this starts from C-level until really each single student help which works with the customers, perhaps on a sales surface. So this is the first thing I do, that I say we have to work on the mission and integrate sustainability in the mindset of the company. And it should not be a single department, or the worst thing is if somebody is doing sustainability and has a normal operational role, so he will always be in between and you always have to work first for the thing where you earn money and not where you spend the money. This was my, I think, the biggest learning in the last years. And I think the more we had the pressure from legal constraints, which was good because we did force really people to think about and to start with sustainability, the more you could see that many, many good projects and really intelligent solutions, innovations, all the great startup scene, really, they brought so many inputs to the companies, but most of them are not scalable. And as long as the solutions are not scalable, they will never bring success. Because in terms of pricing, you will never be able to bring the product really to customers. And only if we have a scalable product, we can also give an impact. And we want to do an impact. We don't want to have greenwashing. We want to really have an impact on the planet, on the business, on economics, on everything. Yeah. So that's my learnings from this. So have a look what kind of company you want to work with. And if you want to work with companies where sustainability is not really in the mindset, I think it's a waste of time.
Thank you. Matt, when we first met, I think already 1.5 years ago, we talked also about, you know, for Gore, the strategy is to become a regenerative business model. And as an ingredient brand, you have a very specific role in the supply chain in general. How exactly do you position yourself as an enabler for the ecosystem?
So just for clarity's sake, our bold aspiration, which we've had for a number of years now, is really to transform our business to help lead an industry towards a more regenerative future. It's already ingrained in our heads, and we've been trying to pursue that. It's huge, and we know that, and we all believe that the road to that that destination goes through circularity. How are we positioning ourselves, or how are we working as an enabler? In some ways, it's doing a lot of what we've already done, but pivoting towards this new situation that we have. I like the African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We really embrace that. We think about it a lot. The brand promise for the Gore-Tex brand is actually going further together. And that helps us to really focus on our collaborative way of working, our role that we've had. For many, many years, we've been enabling lots and lots of partners in the ecosystem to have a better business, to deliver more value to the end user, whether it's through our material science, through our testing, through field trials, through our certification of our factories, everything we do, which takes us far beyond being a supplier. That's really the first step, is that mindset of working together and really trying to go far beyond just simply a step in the supply chain. So we talked then about using some of those capabilities, that thinking in general, and applying it to the circular economy. Some things that we already do, like train and certify repair centers to do repairs on our products. Those are already in place. We can leverage those potentially. But we basically start by saying, okay, it's really about looking for those win-win opportunities, listening to try and understand the needs of the different partners, We start with our brand partners, but it also is then our retailers. We do co-marketing with our retailers today because there's consumer education that needs to happen. People need to understand that why this much more technical, more durable gear is actually a higher price, so they'll make a better choice. So we continue to apply that then into this kind of a setting. And a lot of it comes down to really listening, trying to understand what those problems are. And the work that we've done in this project, you know, it definitely helped us to take that to a much deeper level than some of the previous work that we've done to try and understand those issues from a resale operations perspective, also from a buyer and seller perspective, consumer, because that's ultimately when we're talking about enabling an ecosystem, you're talking about trying to help the organizations that are all trying to serve that end user. And we call that also, you know, bundling the power of many. Yeah. So how can we take what we know, create complementary value through a series of a row of opportunities and different partners, bring those capabilities together and create, deliver and capture new value together. Hopefully that's getting to the point. No,
It absolutely does. Yeah. And since the beginning, I really enjoyed our conversations with Gore, because we as an initiative, you know, we try to build these ecosystems. But to meet an industry player that actually kind of also enables an ecosystem and other players as well is really unique. And that's why we really enjoyed working together with you. Jens, Bergzeit is one of the front runners when it comes to re-commerce. I'm wondering what led the decision to actually engage in the re-commerce space, and generally, how's it going, and what are the main challenges you face, maybe?
So, thank you for having me here. And I guess to answer this is about 4 years ago. We thought about the second-hand business and the second-hand program. It came up in the consumer, in our opinion at least, and we thought it's a good idea to be more sustainable, and we thought it's a good idea to keep the product in use. And we all know that there are a lot of products in the closets at home which are not in use anymore, so we can take them back, we buy them back and bring them back on the market and sell them again. So the original idea was the sustainability, to bring the clothes and the products in a longer usage. And nowadays, we also see advantages on the loyalty side. So we have more contact points to the consumers and gain them back and keep them in the backside business. And the second part of the question was how it's going. A retailer always says it's good, but it could be better. In fact, it's good, and we are developing, we are growing. Everything is fine, and we keep on running.
All right, thank you. Max, you are, a true entrepreneur. You built your whole career kind of within the re-commerce space. So obviously you saw some big potential entering that space. And what you did with Reverse Supply or now Trove Europe is basically enabling, from an operational business, right, point of view, re-commerce. So you have a lot of touch points with all the different kind of players in that space, from consumers, retailers, brands. Maybe, share a bit of your perspective. Why is that such an interesting market that you go all in, and how is it going? What are your main learnings?
Yeah, so originally the text says Reverse Supply. I founded Reverse Supply, which was a German startup empowering re-commerce and resale for brands and retailers like Bergzeit and many others. We now joined Trove, a San Francisco-based U.S. company that some of you may know. They power resale programs for brands like Patagonia, Levi's, Carhartt, and many others. We're now bringing the tech suite and potential of Trove to Europe, which also includes repairs and other topics. And I think that really shows that the potential of resale and re-commerce in Europe holds today. So I think if we look at fashion and retail, it's an industry that's doing well, but could be better, as Jens said. So I like that because you always have issues with overstock returns that have been used that you can't resell at full price. And obviously, fashion has a bad impact, like environmentally speaking today, and by building a system that enables you to send back products, reset them again. We think that there's a possibility to change the business model and build something where higher quality items, longer lifetimes, better durability is incentivized and something that all actors in the market kind of work towards too. I think if I look at the last, 3 to 4 years, I think every entrepreneur that's building in the circular economy will agree with me. It's tough to build and run a business in the circular economy. It's not easy to get funded. It's not easy to start programs that are big enough to make an impact at an early level. But we really see that in the last, 6 to 10 months, the market is opening up more. Deals that we've been chasing are coming through. More brands are actively engaging and trying to get in on the topic of e-commerce and resale. Yeah? Whether that's about stuff that's already in the warehouse, stuff that's that they're buying back from consumers, or overstock and excess inventory that has to go. There's different angles to it, and we're excited to make that happen and now drive that change that is already happening in Europe.
Christina, we talk always about how innovative solutions, people like Max are driving and all this innovation that is coming into the market from the startup point of view, right? And you have a lot of experiences with big companies, leading companies in their field. How do you think we can get those kind of companies to make similar bold decisions and drive innovations forward, maybe more on the, on the level where real decision makers are sitting in and are enabling? How do we enable those decision makers to make the right decisions?
I like very much the words of Alexander this morning for the opening speech where he said, you have to work together. So that means the startups have to work together, but the same as the big companies have to work together, because otherwise nobody can take the costs for it. And also from startup side, I think what is very important, a big company cannot rely on one single startup to produce anything or give any certain innovation to them, because they have to secure their supply chain, they have to secure delivery, and to have the products always for sale. If anything happens to the company, the small startup, then what should they do? So I think the startups have to work together. And I just give you one example. For example, Hugo Boss invested a lot in HiQ Ionic. It's a yarn based on cellulose. So I don't want to go into this detail, but it's a beautiful story. It's also beautiful collections we can do, but it's not scalable. So we can do 300 units, 500 units. We can put it on the market like little collections, but it can never enter into the big production of Hugo Boss. And of course, all of you want to go into the big production, you want to go into the big companies, and therefore you have to work together. Otherwise it will not work. And also the stronger the brand cannot afford to make any mistake. That means you have to test also the products for a long time on the way what you're doing. And if I talk about reuse, for example, also Hugo Boss founded their little company inside was pre-loved. But we did realize it does not work. It doesn't make sense, because you have to look on the consumer side. The consumer, they have Hugo Boss, they have whatever brand they have in their wardrobe, and they want to send it back. So it doesn't make sense that every single company is running a pre-loved program. We should collaborate. So Hugo Boss, for example, he decided to collaborate now with Selfie, because that's real life. The customer takes the Selfie bag and they put 5, 6, 7 different brands inside and they send it to Selfie. So we should never forget to think from a customer view what they expect, because they decide what they buy and how they buy and where they buy. Yeah?
Thank you.
And I think we have to give more transparency what is going on in the startup area. For example, many supervisory board members, they should be here, I think. They should see what is going on, where the innovative people talk to them. We should bring you together with more people who work on strategic issues and companies. And I think that a connection is not good enough.
Right. That's a great point. Mm-hmm. Matt, you're part of the Futures team within Gore, and product lifetime extension is, you know, like re-commerce is just one part of product lifetime extension. And I know that you are like looking at product lifetime extension intensively. Can you run us through your thoughts and your, where do you see opportunities? What's your take on that?
Sure. So obviously it all starts with the durability of the product, and that's where we're positioned really well to work with partners like Berkside and others for models like reuse. And certainly the idea of extending the life of a product because of the impact that it has on our carbon footprint is already an important part of how we're thinking. And we definitely want to continue to leverage that. And we're looking a lot of different ways in the futures team that allow us to imagine and create new, actually product life extension is important. We're actually talking about product lifetime value. How do we actually make sure that the product is constantly within the view of brands or people in the ecosystem? How are we making sure that if somebody would rather access a product, they can do that? And we actually maintain then the knowledge of where that product is. I know that we have some discussions about product identification as being one of the challenges that's faced in the re-commerce space, looking at those kind of opportunities. Anything that we think would be valuable, enabling or otherwise, that we can say that's going to keep that product in use more often by potentially multiple users, multiple steps in its life journey, rather than moving, continuing to work with a very standard linear sell it once and it disappears into the ether. Yeah. So we're working on exploring both from a consumer standpoint, because again, if we're trying to work within the ecosystem, it's all about serving that end user. As you said, you know, it's what they want. It's what they are going to choose as an option. It's not about what's more sustainable. At the end of the day, that might be a deselection criteria, but it's really about creating value that they care about and they're willing to pay for. And we'll be looking basically at a lot of different options. Like I said, we're looking at access models, we're looking at the data challenges, and definitely we continue to look at the e-commerce space.
Jens, we said in the beginning, re-commerce is a great way to decouple growth from volume. Sounds great, should be on every pitch deck, sounds beautiful, but it's actually not as easy as it sounds, right? Like, we realize that scalability and profitability in that space of re-commerce is not that easy to achieve. How do you evaluate this as a business model, and how do you face those challenges of scalability and profitability?
I think, first of all, we didn't thought too much about it. So we just started and did something and then learned our experience. And of course, we have to make money or not to lose money, first of all. So we have to calculate that our business is more or less positive. And we think that the second efforts, the second effects, as important as the money as we can make with it. For example, the loyalty aspect is very important for us. We can get another touch to our consumers, especially the one that bought already something at Berkside. And we get in contact with new consumers, and we can also see that we convert consumers on the second-hand market to our first-hand business. So we see these consumer movements behind these different spaces, and that helps us to make it more valuable, this program, and useful for us. But it's obvious that we have to do it profitable, otherwise we are not interested in scaling this business, and we need a better scale to have a better impact on the environment.
Right. Max, I mean, you work with Berkside together, you run the operations, you're all about the operations. From your point of view, what is required in order to make the re-commerce space at Berkside and your other clients a profitable business case? And to what extent is new technology crucial to get there?
So at the end of the day, what we're doing is on the operational side, logistics, efficiency, and kind of data play. So we have to take these three things and make them work together as well as possible, right? So you mentioned scalability. I think that's key. And if something is scalable and the unit economics work out, we can make it profitable. And then it's an interesting business case for companies to jump into. And we do that by leveraging product catalogs, product data from our partners that we have access to. We're building technology around AI and machine learning, computer vision, where we basically help operators in the 3PL facilities that we work with to inspect an item faster, to get the product data together faster that we need in order to merchandise and sell the article well on a storefront, on another platform, on a marketplace. We're essentially a tech company and try to get as many things together to drive efficiency, bring handling costs, handling processing times down, and of course we want to make money, but pass that on to our partners so they can build a profitable business around re-commerce, secondhand, and take pack to build a bigger impact that also helps the bottom line at the end of the day, right?
Can you share a bit like how the process looks like when you receive an old garment and like take us through the process until we actually can sell it again, and why is it so expensive? Like what are the biggest steps?
I think it's not as expensive as you think, but it costs money, right? Because there's handling involved. So when garments come to one of our facilities, we check them in. When you go on Bergzeit, for example, on the reuse platform, you can register, an old jacket, an old gore jacket, of course, that you have at home. You would get a gift card for it or money paid out to your bank account. You get a prepaid shipping label, ship that to our facility, we scan that, and then our operators know what's in the parcel. We take the garments, we identify them. If we have catalog data from the brand, we could look at the hang tag, or hang tag is mostly gone on a pre-owned garment, right? But at the care label, type in a number and pull up all the product information that we have. That's, of course, a big benefit that we have versus players like Selpi, who don't have access to a lot of data and have to bring every product attribute in from scratch and put that in manually. We can also do that if we do not have product data available or we can't access it from anywhere. And we basically check the garment, look for spots, look for signs of usage, type that into the system, and then the system automatically and objectively says, this is something that we can accept, this is something that we cannot accept, it's not fit for resale because it's used too heavily. These we can return to the customer or divert to recycling or donation. And if the garment can be resold, we clean it, we steam it, refurbish it, if needed, if it makes sense, shoot pictures if we cannot leverage original product data, and then, put it on the shelf, and it's ready for resale, and the next person can buy it. So that's, in a minute, the process.
Thanks for for explaining it.
I just want to say that we are in the auto industry, we are in a very good position because we have high-value products. So it's easier for us to make it more profitable. It's almost not profitable to sell such a T-shirt in a second-hand market. It's pretty hard. We have these products. We have that because our assortment should have a right wide range. But we have the higher product value, and that's where we can make our money with. Yeah, and that's working.
Christina, last time we spoke, you mentioned a couple of projects that also are focusing on the re-commerce market, but like in a slightly different way. Can you share a couple of these
examples? It's more the surplus materials that really remain. So in high-end luxury, LVMH has founded Nonasource. So this is a platform of online store and also a very nice showroom in Paris, for example. And they sell all the dead stock of their big brands like Celine Dior, all really, really nice products. And you can buy all the fabrics and the leather. And what is really great there, they offer it to young designers and other smaller brands who have never access to these high-quality materials. And beside this, also young designers can go there and they get a real training there, and they tell them about sustainability. They consult them what kind of material is used for which type of garment. And you can get the delivery in 3 to 5 days. So also, I think they start with many young creative people and to give them the right direction on their way. And also Hugo Boss, for example, for all the we said repurposing the leftover materials we found at 8 yards. So it just went live this January now. It's 100% a daughter of Hugo Boss. And there we have three options. So either you can just buy there your fabrics, or you can really go there and say, I need, for example, for a big event or anything, I need 100 hoodies. Can you please produce them for me in a special way or with prints or whatever? So this is also done by the leftovers of Hugo Boss. And the third party is that you get really people in and you are creative with them. So, for example, we worked just with a big hotel group and they wanted to have some blankets for the hotel beds where you unpack your luggage that you also cover your bed. So also to rethink the purpose of the fabric, even though it was perhaps, a suit before and we have leftovers and then a hotel group will do the blankets for their beds. Really to use everything what has ever been produced, and it's a high quality fabrics that give really a purpose to them. And I wanted to add one thing, what you said. I think the lower the price of the product, the more it goes versus recycling, the higher the value is its repair or a second life.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Matt, we have been working for like a year now on our Recommerce project. We obviously had a lot of learnings along the way, consumer perspectives, the operational side, how to unlock supply. Like, what are your personal biggest learnings out of that project?
First, just kind of for context, reminding the way that we approached it and why we started working in this context at all. Obviously, we've talked about the durability premium level of products as being something that'd be more interesting. But we had seen a lot of growth in re-commerce and fashion, and we'd seen a lot of struggling pilots in our own space with those outdoor products. So we figured, what's going on here? Why can't our products and our brand partners and our retail partners get as much traction as what we're seeing in some of the other areas? So we took a really systems-oriented approach, and we were thinking about, again, what it means to be an operator, challenges there, what it means to be a buyer of used, and also what it would mean to be a seller of used. I would say probably two of the biggest learnings for me. Number one is the complexity is really, really clear. You know, we had spent a lot of time talking to partners, but it wasn't really until we got into this kind of collaborative environment and really got, you know, peel back the layers of the onion and really understand the complexity. So we had really heard a lot of talk about unlocking that supply and trying to meet that challenge of getting more people to take their idle Gore-Tex gear and put it back into e-commerce because it's good for everybody. Found that that's one challenging, but also that it has to be done in a way that isn't going to disrupt what's already a pretty lean process. So the integration of our solution into your processes would then be something that we didn't quite understand in the detail that we understand it today. And that helps us to go back, pivot, and think about how we might approach the challenges in a new way. So the reality of the complexity there was really important to us. The second was probably more it's related to that, but when you actually get in there and do, learning by doing, actually finding a lot of insights for about consumers through survey work and qualitative and doing interviews with other operators. We did some global work, a multinational research, led us to some interesting conclusions, but it wasn't until we started doing this and you really say, hey, there seems to be a really high level of interest for, you know, the solution we were talking about, which is some kind of certified use process for Gore-Tex products. But it wasn't until we actually did it and we saw that the reality of the say and do gap in practice, that, you know, the high level of interest doesn't always translate into the activity because we didn't get a lot of product back. Yeah, and doing it with your platform to make it as real as possible, we have some real confidence in the data. It's going to help us to, you know, that's the kind of learning, the level of granular learning that you can only do when you get into this, with partners that are operating in the space. So that's also something I would recommend as well, is that everybody has a go at collaborating in this kind of an environment, because the learning and the depth of learning is a completely different one than anything else that we could do.
Interesting thing is, in our project, we didn't get that much products back. But beside this project, we do get a lot of products, and we can buy a lot of products, even Gore-Tex and hardshell jackets. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a hint, last May, when you compare last May to January, January was one of our best months, and last May was not such a strong month. We have 8 times as much products bought back in this time period of 10 months. Mm-hmm. So this is a quite good development for us, and we see that the consumer reacts to this. And we didn't do that much marketing in between for the sellers. We do marketing for the buyers to buy our products, but we do get the supply and we do get the products, mm-hmm. All kind of products.
We look at the number of products that are going out into the market every year. And Germany, a German-speaking area, is a really important region for the Gore-Tex brand. It's still a tiny fraction. You know, added up over the year, lifetime of our products can vary, but you know, if you average it 10 years, it's still a tiny drop in the bucket. And we still believe that there is potential to unlock that supply of high-quality premium ewes that's going to make a better impact on your business. But it's great to hear. I think there's also a generational shift that's helping that to accelerate nonetheless.
Yeah. There must be a lot of potential, because we don't do a lot of advertisement for this kind of products. So they just come right now. And what will happen when we push it stronger?
And that brings me actually exactly to the next question. Like, what do you realize motivates your customers to buy secondhand, but also to sell their products?
To sell their products is, I guess, easy. We pay money for it.
And they could still sell it on peer-to-peer, right? Like in a different way.
Of course. When they sell it peer-to-peer, they get more money, of course, because we have our costs in between. But I think we do it on an easy way. So it's more or less easy for you to sell the products. You just have to say, I want to sell something, and you get this shipping labels and everything, and you don't have to do anything anymore. So I guess we don't have specific surveys, but we think we get these consumers, they sell something for the first time or for the beginning. And we don't address the second-hand heavy users, because they do it on their own. So we are on the starter of second-hand people, they try to sell something. Yes, and on the buyer side, it's we don't have a lot of service on this part as well. But I think, and that's our hypothesis, that we buy the high-quality products and the expensive brands for less money. So you can achieve, or you can buy a 800 jacket for, let's say, 400 euro. And for some of them, for some of our consumers, might this reason to buy something. And the others, of course, do it because it's sustainable and they think it's a cool idea and want to push this idea. And you get a lot of good products for less price.
Max, before we open for the Q&A from the audience, last question to you. I mean, you obviously have a lot of clients, not just Bergzeit, many other clients. Trove even has more clients, also across different industries, not only outdoor, it's fashion. What are your experience and your general learnings when you work with all of these clients?
So when we started, a lot of pushback from brands when initially reached out comes like, okay, we're going to open re-commerce, resale. We offer similar or the same products, pre-owned, slightly owned at a lower price point. Is it gonna cannibalize our mainline sales? That's of course like a tough question to answer because it would take the brand a leap of faith to get over that. But we do actually have a lot of data by now to prove that it doesn't. In fact, it helps. Yeah. So as Jens said, you get access to a new group of people that maybe previously didn't shop before because the price is too high, and on top you kind of re-engage with your existing consumers, prompt them to trade in stuff for gift card, for cash, and kind of have different touch points along the life cycle with them. Yeah, so it's not actually cannibalizing, but helping grow your mainline business while growing the secondhand business at the same time, and I think that's a learning for us, that we can now prove this, and also a learning for the partners we work with and that we will work with, that this is actually something that's kind of a win-win situation, yeah, if you will. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Now, the stage is yours. Like, are there any questions from the audience? I think we have a microphone around as well. Any questions?
Yeah. Maybe one that Christina was saying, you need to have a leader that wants to do it. We were at an event earlier this week. It was about the IDGs, these inner direction goals. Particularly to you, Max, now being part of Trove, you might not have the Trove story, but you have your own history and data points. What do you observe in terms of readiness on the leaders as individuals that actually want to have a different way of doing business, but really business, not just being good, but really business? What did you observe? What are the patterns in these leaders?
I think the companies that we as Reverse Supply, now Trove Europe, partnered up with is that many of them are forward-thinking. They're either big enough to make an impact, and they're kind of aware of their responsibility, also at a leadership level, or they just have a problem that we can help them solve. Yeah, whether it's customer retention, bringing that up, or dealing with non-new returns, stuff that's sitting in the warehouse and can't be resolved. It's been sitting there for months. Yeah. They have a problem, and when we approach them, we can solve that problem for them. Yeah, but what you said, what we discussed, is correct. I think you need to make this work. Ownership at the, let's say, CEO executive level in a company, and as in the case of Bergzeit, a team or somebody in the team that actively drives this forward on a daily basis to make it as successful as Bergzeit is doing it, or some of the other clients that we're working with in Europe and the US. So, yeah.
Nice. Any other questions from the audience? Yeah.
Thanks for the panel. I had a question on the recent
Measures taken by Europe when it comes to either eco-design of textiles or, you know, mandatory EPR schemes, etc. But one recently has been discussed on putting a fee on packages that come from China under a certain value. I think it's 150 euro, putting a 2 euro handling fee, they call it. And because you've all talked about the importance of price point, of course the market's been flooded by very cheap fast fashion products. To an extent, and if you're really honest, because nobody's listening here, is it something that you welcome? Because in a way, it drives your business as well. Because anything that's cheaper than new is going to be a potential market for you.
I think for any e-commerce player in Europe, and I'm interested in your perspective as well, Jens, I think it's an issue that you have the stuff coming in from Asia at a significantly lower price point because it makes it harder to compete, and these guys don't play by the same rules as anybody in Europe does. And certainly, if we look at the value proposition of secondhand and resale, it's something that people with less disposable income can afford. They can afford higher quality products, garments in our case, and this may motivate them to go to a less sustainable consumption decision, basically. Yeah. So I think it's an issue. I think everybody in e-commerce and re-commerce will welcome if there are measures that will take place to make this less, yeah? And I think it's happening. I think these companies are also cutting back their marketing spend in Europe at the moment. But yeah, I think it's definitely an issue for anybody in the industry, right? Yeah.
I can say I haven't talked to my colleagues, and I don't know what our company currently has a statement for this, but our target group buys high brands with high value. And I think our target group doesn't switch to the cheaper Chinese products. So I think we are not affected that strongly by this discussion, because in our main business, the people are willing to buy a jacket for 800 euros. And yeah, that's a part of our target group.
I think if at a European level, the answer to this would be that we push more circular and sustainable business model that models forward that cater to a similar need to buy something at a lower price point to deal with this, I think, of course, we would welcome it, right? That'd be amazing.
Thank you very much for all your insights and for this great conversation. Unfortunately, our time is up, but you're all around, I think, at least today, if not also tomorrow. So please feel free to reach out, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
This was another episode in our series about the Circular Republic Festival 2025. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.